This is AM 950, the voice of Minnesota. Welcome to the program. My name is Jack Rice. I'm in for Matt McNeil. You may remember me. I've been on with Matt many times over the years. I actually had a program here at AM 950 years ago, and I have to tell you, sitting in studio again, kind of sort of resting myself back in the chair, in the big chair, just stretching out with you, is something that I'm thrilled to do. Because I have to tell you, I spend my days walking into courtrooms. I spend my days arguing before juries. As a criminal defense lawyer, I'm dealing sort of neck deep in issues of criminal justice and reform and so many other issues on a daily basis, but not in the academic sense, not in the big picture sense. Sometimes it's the minutiae piece. It's in the trenches pieces of it that really drive me, but more than drive me, they sort of surround me and sometimes envelop me. And so when Matt asked me to step in, I was pretty thrilled. I was pretty thrilled because you and I, we get to talk about what this stuff means and what's going on in the world and the political aspect, especially of this criminal side, especially of the criminal justice side and about where we're going, is something that I really wanted to dig into for the next couple of hours as I sit in for Matt. And by the way, coming up, when I come back on the 16th, Jerry Blackwell, who was actually the prosecutor who did the openings, some of the direct and cross-examination and the closings in the Derek Chauvin case, he, for the first time, is actually going to come in studio and talk about what it was like to be in the eye of the storm. Now, I want to take you back to May 25th of 2000. That was the day that some have said changed everything. The day that George Floyd was murdered in the street on the corner of 38th and Chicago. Now, I would tell you that that's not true. I would tell you that that's not actually what changed things. And things were changing, and sadly, things are staying the same in many, many ways. Because as I think about this, I recall standing in front of a jury more than a year, maybe 2 years before George Floyd was murdered by Derek Chauvin. And I remember talking about police officers. And I'm standing in front of this jury in Ramsey County in St. Paul, in a St. Paul courtroom. And we were talking about the police. And you could see fundamentally the difference between what a jury looks at when they think about police. Because I can take you back to 20 years ago, again, as a criminal defense attorney and as a former prosecutor. And what you would see at many times in the past was holding up officers as godlike. And I heard that and saw that again, almost to the point that they are above the fray. They're not human. What they do is for society, for humanity. And they would never be questioned. Well, that's not really what I saw 2 years before the death of George Floyd. Now, fast forward to the buildup to the trial after Mr. Floyd's death. William Mitchell School of Law actually started a program. They started a class on the Derek Chauvin trial itself. And I've been thinking about why you would do this. And that's the reason I wanted to bring in Rick Petrie. Rick Petrie is a criminal defense lawyer and has been for many years, although he has a lot of experience doing all sorts of other things too. But he currently serves as the Assistant Director of Career and Professional Development at Mitchell Hamlin. And he joins me. Rick, thank you so much for joining the program.
Yeah, thank you for the invitation. I think this is a very important and still timely conversation.
Well, I appreciate it because I don't see this as a conversation of what happened in May of 2020. I see this as a question of sort of where we're going. But maybe the first question I have for you is, why did Mitchell Hamlin decide to start a program like this, to start a trial class?
Yeah, you know, after this happened, We had a number of students that took sort of two different positions. One group of students said, this has been so traumatic, because you got to keep in mind that many of our students, you know, lived in that neighborhood. And with them, to be at home during the riots, during the time the National Guard was in the street and all of that stuff, was a big deal for them. They're trying to go to law school, but it, you know, they go home and they're dealing with that. So that group of students said, it's too much. We don't want to hear any more about it. We want nothing to do with it. We just wish that it would go away. But at the same time, we had another group of students who said, wow, this is happening right here in our backyard. And there seems to be a lot going on that we could learn from, and we want to walk right into it. And so to accommodate that second group of students, we decided to put together a course so that they could have those conversations, so that they could learn a number of the lessons that came out of that trial. And so we put together the class, and we had it. It worked great.
Rick Petrie is my guest. He's with Mitchell Hamlin, talking about not just the Derek Chauvin trial, but really the class that they were building, and maybe a reflection of sort of where we're going in the criminal justice system. But I think these evolving views of the criminal justice system, of law enforcement, of how it all fits together. You're joining me. My name is Jack Rice here on AM 950. You know, Rick, when you think about that, and you think about, you know, starting this program for those two different groups, and I have to tell you, I live 10 blocks from where this happened too. And, you know, I had children in the streets, and it's a really strange It's a strange thing when you see this from a generational standpoint, when you see this shifting, evolving view as it's changing sort of underneath your feet.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, this time was different from every other situation like this that I've experienced. You know, like you, I've been around this stuff for a long time. But for the first time, I don't know if it was because of the video or if it was because of the amount of time or the dynamics involved with the murder or what it was, but there was something different about this that literally resonated around the world. You know, I was talking to somebody about it last week, and they said, well, don't forget, it happened during the middle of a pandemic. And so everybody was home, everybody was watching TV, and everybody was already sort of on edge because of the pandemic, and then we piled this on top of it. And so with all of that in mind, you know, for the first time after this occurred, I had people calling me from different parts of the United States, even people from other countries that I know, saying, hey, I don't know what I can do. I don't know if there's anything I can do, but I just feel like I have to do something. I've seen this happen in the past. It didn't really have a direct impact on me, and I just thought, well, that's kind of too bad, but it doesn't have a direct impact on me, so I'm going to go on and continue to live my life. But now I don't think I can do that anymore. What can I do?
No, it got me thinking. It got me thinking, you know, Rick, about this, and as I said at the opening, that as a criminal defense lawyer, I'm regularly surrounded by police reports. And so I was, I was in a courtroom about an hour and a half before, just this afternoon. And so what you do is you open up a file and you're reading a police report, and everybody in the room may be reading that same report. And you start with that as your jumping off point. And the real question is something you have to start, you ask yourself regularly is this even true? I mean, if we look at what happened with George Floyd, if you look at the initial reports that the Minneapolis Police Department actually put out to themselves about what happened in the street, it simply did not reflect reality. And I think that dichotomy, that space between what they said and what was, that was undeniable, was, I think, it was massive in terms of how it impacted people who watched it, saw it, and then heard about that.
Yeah, and I think it speaks to the culture of the Minneapolis Police Department. You touched on this earlier. For those folks to be so brazen to put out that type of a statement that's completely unsupported by fact or reality speaks volumes to the fact that they believed that they could, and that if they did, that it would be just fine. And if you think about it, you take out the video and just have the statements, we're in a whole different place. We don't have riots. We don't have property damage. We probably don't even wind up with a charge. And so that speaks to this issue, and I'm glad you brought it up, because just to be candid about it, this has been an issue for a long time. It's an issue that a lot of people have known about, but that just got kicked down the road over and over and over and over again until the point where it finally reached a boiling point. And so that's what I think we're seeing now. It's like the covers have been pulled back to this reality. I mean, you know, think about it. People don't make those kind of statements if they don't think they can and they can get away with it, right? I mean, come on. You've been around this stuff a long time.
But Rick, come on. Hold on. You and I both know this, that despite all that, despite what we know that the statements were by the Minneapolis Police Department, and then the video and all of the evidence and all of the witnesses, and in fact, not just one video, how many videos do we have now, right? When you start seeing this angle and that angle, plus the vest cams and everything else, all of a sudden you saw a much, much different picture. And yet, nevertheless, we're still seeing that split in society. Those who are saying, duh, we have been fighting this issue for 400 years. And then you will have people on the other side saying, what do you expect the police to do? I mean, look how hard it is for them. If George Floyd had just done this, do you know how bad his record was? All of these different things, those arguments continue despite all of that to come out.
Yeah, they do, and that takes us to, I think, another very important point, which is the American justice system. It's certainly not perfect, but when it works like it's supposed to, it works pretty good. And that means that all the presumption of innocence, the right to a trial, all of those things have to be honored. Otherwise, you just say, well, hey, we pulled this guy over. He was giving us a rough time, and we got tired of it, so we killed him. And that's easy to do when the person who got killed is not tied to you in any sort of way. But you know, just like I do, every single defendant that I've ever represented says, yeah, but it's me, wait a minute. And the families always say, yeah, but it's my son, it's my husband, it's my daughter, it's my wife, it's my whatever. And I want them to have the absolute best defense that they can have. Well, that can only happen. This system can only work when it works, when everybody plays by the rules. Because otherwise what you end up with is you say, yeah, we want the bad guys to play by the rules, but not the so-called good guys. Well, that doesn't work. Everybody's got to play by the same set of rules, and the whole thing goes to heck.
Here's a tough question then. We think about the young woman, that young girl, the 17-year-old, actually saying, this is what I saw. This is why I pulled my phone out. We had multiple other witnesses talking about this on the street on 38th and in Chicago. Without the videotapes and just the statements, right? Just the statements from let's face it, African-American people on this street. And is should that mean nothing, something? It shouldn't. But because of that, would there have been a charge otherwise? Your thought?
I doubt it. I really doubt it. I mean, because if you look at that and you look at the dynamics, you've got these statements coming from these young African-American women against the statements of what probably turns out to be a whole bunch of police officers who are going to put up the blue wall They're going to, and you know this just like I do, they're going to have their meeting after the incident. They're going to say, okay, here's our story. And then that's the story that's going to come out, and they're going to stick together, and they're going to continue to tell that story. And then let's just say that for whatever reason, it's a miracle, and it does get charged, and it goes to trial. Now we run up against this dynamic where we've got the exact opposite of what we saw here, where members of the Minneapolis Police Department actually came out and testified against one of their own. And instead of that, we've got the blue wall of silence. We've got these officers who are standing arm in arm. They're all testifying to the same story against these young African-American women. And you tell me, in a Hennepin County jury, who, by the way, almost never looks like this jury look. Let's not forget that. You tell me how that's going to go. And even if you look at voir dire, you know this as well as I do, too. In the old days, you'd ask these members of the jury, if you're trying to figure out bias, you know, are you more inclined to believe a police officer than just any regular person? And most of the time they would say, yeah, I think the police officer is probably telling the truth.
Most of the time? I'll tell you what, Rick Petrie is my guest. Rick, stay with me, because when we come back, I'm gonna talk about the power of that videotape, but I also want to talk about exactly how the prosecution handled the Minneapolis Police Department and really how they characterized themselves as above the fray, as they saw themselves as different than Derek Chauvin, and tried to create as much space as possible, and it just seemed to sit there. There's a lot more to come when it comes to this question of race, law enforcement, criminal justice. Are we different? Are we changing? Are we evolving? Or is it just a lot more of the same? My name is Jack Rice. I'm in for Matt McNeil, and this is AM 950. This is AM 950, the Matt McNeil Show. Jack Rice in today, sitting in the big chair, trying to fill his shoes. Let's face it, it's not going to happen, but I'm here. And it's great to be back in studio, having a program here for years myself, and being a guest with Matt so many different times. My guest today is Rick Petrie. Again, he serves as the Assistant Director of Career and Professional Development at Mitchell Hamlin School of Law. But we're talking about a course that he's co-teaching or co-taught regarding the Derek Chauvin trial. Again, Rick, thank you so much for staying with me.
Sure, it's good to be here.
Well, and again, I appreciate this, because to me, this question is one that I've always struggled with. And if I look back at this historically, this is the problem that I'm afraid of. Every time we see a police officer act inappropriately, what we get is the one bad apple rule, or at least the one bad apple claim. What you get is the police department will then come in, and they'll either do that blue wall where they protect everybody and say, what's the problem? Nothing happened here. And that's the end of it. And typically that is the end of it. Or worse come worse, when they're cornered, what you will get is the one bad apple. This guy was a bad guy. We're great guys, and you have to trust us. He's the bad guy. And the problem that we have is that frequently neither of those options reflect reality.
Yeah, and I think that's absolutely correct. You know, let's look at one of the examples. You know, he's the bad guy, we're all good guys. But you can't have one bad guy that's been bad this many times that gets to survive in a culture of good guys, because the good guys wouldn't tolerate it. Let's just be honest about that.
Well, if that's the case, then why, and I'll go straight at it. I'm watching this trial. and I'm watching Chief Arredondo, and I'm watching two of his senior deputies talking about the Minneapolis Police Department. And they're talking about the quality of the department and how this is not how they behave, how they are above this, and that they teach differently, they taught differently, their standards are different, their approach is different, and Derek Chauvin is an outlier. He is not part of who we are. And yet, as you've just described, this wasn't his first run-in. This wasn't his first problem. We understand the number of problems, let alone the $20 million that was paid out to another case just before that, which was record-breaking, and the problems that the Minneapolis Police Department have had again and again and again. And despite what do we get? They decided to go with the one bad apple problem.
Yeah, you know, that's a complicated issue. It's on the one hand, looking specifically at what was going on with the city and, you know, the nation and around the world at this time, you know, they had to come up with something, because the city was on fire. The police had sat down. The mayor had talked about defunding the police department. The president of the city council had said something along those lines. When the police sat down, the crime rate went up. So we got a real mess going on. So we got that stuff happening. At the same time, keep in mind that Arredondo had previously sued the department before he became the chief. So he was aware of this stuff going on. And I think he had tried to make some changes, but I think a lot of this stuff was so deeply embedded in the culture of the MPD, it was very difficult to make those changes. Here's an example. You have these officers that would do bad things, and then they would get written up and go through the civilian review board, and perhaps there's a decision made to fire them. Then the officer goes to arbitration. The arbitrator finds, yeah, probably did something bad, but you can't fire him. Why not? Because you haven't fired anybody else, so you're treating this guy more harshly than you treated everybody else. So now we got this crazy, vicious cycle going on.
They're racing to the bottom, right? So in other words, the standard is, well, because we've got so many bad guys in here and we don't generally do anything with the bad guys, when we find another bad guy, hold on, we have to treat him exactly like we treat the other ones.
Yeah, and that's kind of how it turned out. But I think there's another piece of the puzzle as well, and that is that there was a big part of this MPD culture that's just the way it rolled, right? I mean, this isn't the first time that some sort of allegations about Minneapolis police doing bad things have surfaced. That, let's not forget the gang task force, where they had cops, you know, taking property from people. This stuff never wind up even in the property room or getting accounted for. They would just take the stuff home. Now, these are the same people that are supposed to be, you know, seeing about bad guys right, that are stealing stuff, You know, and so this stuff has been around for a long time. And as I mentioned earlier, a lot of it would just get kicked down the road. They would pay out these small settlements and then, you know, be back to business as usual. You know, they had the thumpers, too. So this stuff has been around for a long time.
Rick Petrie is my guest here on AM 950. As we think about this, I mean, I can give you examples, and I've had cases of my own, Rick, in both Minneapolis and St. Paul, where I have seen exactly this, where what ends up happening is you'll have officers who may do bad things. And then what will happen is they create this fictional wall between the civil side and what's going on in their professional side. So what I'll have is a criminal case, and I don't even find out about what's happening to them in their employment situation because of all of these bad acts. Because they're saying, ooh, that information is protected because we're doing an investigation. Even if they've made conclusions, they just haven't released them. I, on the criminal defense side, won't know about it. And what I've been told by judges and others is, hold on, there are Minnesota employment protection rights that they have that will trump, essentially, my right to, the term would be Brady information that's bad that I can't get a hold of because it's protected, because these bad guys are protected by employment protections, even though they continue to do those bad things.
Yeah, you know, that's a problem. That's a dynamic that, you know, the law does provide for certain protections for employment information. But at the same time, you know, that those protections have been pushed out so far, just like this pendulum dealing with police unions has been pushed out so far, that what started out, just like police unions, to be something good has been, I'm just going to say it, sort of bastardized, and now has become something that's exploited so much that it causes a lot of problems and allows people to hide behind these things. You know, here locally, police unions started out as a good thing for good police officers because it was to protect them from bad police chiefs that were trying to get them to do all sorts of crazy things. But now that pendulum has swung the other way, and now it's being used in the exact opposite of what it was intended for in the first place.
Well, I am curious, is there an opportunity here? Well, of course, we have to believe there is, if we're optimists, and I guess I am, so I want to believe that. And yet, as you were just alluding to earlier, this idea that this was so entrenched, this sort of bad cop mentality, not amongst all of them, because I have some of my dear friends who are police officers, but there is this bad cop mentality that is protected by that thin blue line, that this is simply impossible. And you mentioned the struggles of Chief Arredondo, who got pushed back for that very same reason.
Yeah, I think you know, I'm an optimist just like you, and I do believe that this marks a potential turning point. And I say that for a number of reasons. One, again, just looking back at the trial, for the first time, the chief of police came out. Zimmerman came out. Some of the other officers came out and testified against one of their own. I think there's some political reasons that they did that, but I also think that potentially marks a turning point for doing things in a different way.
Well, now, hold on, Rick. I have to ask, honestly, if there was no videotape, do you really think these guys would have said, you know what, I've decided, it's time to take the high road? Do you really think that they would have done something, dare I say it, inconsistent with what we have seen so many times, if they weren't pushed into a corner and it was impossible to support those behaviors?
You know, I think I'm speculating a little bit, but I'll tell you this. I would have been very surprised if you take out the video if they say those things. But with the video and with the eyes of the world on Minneapolis, on the Minneapolis Police Department, with the DOJ investigation heading this way, I think that it provides fertile ground for a turning point. Now, we'll see if that ends up happening or not. But I agree with you. If you take out the video, I think we're right back to where we talked about earlier. I doubt that there would have even been a charge. It would have stuck, you know, stayed with that original story. But you put the video into play and you put the eyes of the world on it, I think it provides that opportunity.
If we look back over, and dare I say this, hundreds of years, I know when it's part of your class, part of this issue was to look historically at how we view the police, how we deal with police officers who might actually be on the stand, not as witnesses, but as defendants. Do we find that what happens is we address this problem in a narrow sense, and then you get that reactionary pushback from supporters of the police, just like we're seeing right now about the police will sit down and then crime goes up. We need to unshackle the police. This happened in New York. This happened in Chicago. This happened in Cleveland. This happened across the country. What makes you think, what makes any of us think that as soon as the police have the opportunity, they will continue to do what we have seen historically?
Well, I think you're absolutely right, and we're seeing it. We actually saw it in the class where this pushback from members of law enforcement comes, and not just from people that are active in law enforcement or formerly active in law enforcement, but even from those who are strong supporters of law enforcement, where they're saying, hey, you're making it impossible now for the police to do their job. Well, that's not true. That's simply not true. And if we stay on this tack that we're on now, with no changes being made, we're really headed for problems. We got the bad guys saying, hey, this is perfect. We got no cops on the street, and so we can do anything we want to. At the same time, we have innocent people who are suffering needlessly, if you ask me, as a result of this, and we've got cops sitting down saying, hey, man, hey, you said you didn't want any cops, so guess what? You got none. How do you like it now? So we can, as a society, we can't continue on that road. And what I'm seeing is a lot of finger-pointing, everybody pointing at each other saying, hey, it's your fault that we got here. Well, we can't stay on that either. We have to get beyond that and start having real conversations about how can we do this better in a way that works better for the community as a whole. Because that's I don't see any other way around that. Otherwise, we're really headed for a disaster.
Rick Petrie joins me from Mitchell Hamlin School of Law. Again, a criminal defense lawyer for many years, plus other things, and we've both been in courtrooms for so long. I think that's a big part of this question. Rick, again, I want you to stay with me because if I leave it there, there's the part of me that will think that this is hopeless. It's got to be better than that. We're going to come back and we're going to talk about what that means, about how do you fix this? How do you resolve this? Is there a way to address the systemic problem of law enforcement and the failures that we're seeing? Because credibility is a massive piece of this. Without credibility, you're not going to get that support that the police department desperately needs to operate. And if you don't have that, where do you go next? My name is Jack Rice. I'm in for Matt McNeil. And I'm actually just here for today. He's on break. What was the term we were going to use, boys? I think it was on assignment. My goodness, I don't even know what that means. Stay with us. A lot more coming up right here on AM 950. You're listening to AM 950, The Matt McNeil Show. Jack Rice in with you today. And again, we've had Rick Petrie with us for the hour. I thought it was critically important as we think about where we're going as a society that we understand what this means and why not just race, but the term which I haven't used yet this hour, which is rule of law, the idea that we're all buying in, that a system actually works, a system that is fair to all, that applies to all, that nobody is above, and that what happens if you don't have it, it's a fundamental piece of this issue. And again, Rick, thank you so much for taking the time. I know you're a busy guy. If we look to the future, does rule of law really work if there's a substantial number of people who simply can historically say, hey, it hasn't worked so far, it hasn't worked particularly well, and it doesn't work for somebody who might look like me, what do you say to that?
That's a good question. That's a question that's made me have to pause before I answer it. But I think my answer is, I believe in the rule of law. I believe that the rule of law works, but it only works if the rules apply across the board and they are enforced, no matter what. See, there's another dynamic here that we didn't talk about. I'm sure you're aware of it, but that's a dynamic for the county attorney who has to rely on the police department to, so this, for lack of a better way to describe it, to make his bed every day, because you've got to rely on these cops to come in and testify. And if you've got a politician who's relying on getting convictions and tough on crime, all those kinds of things, and you need the cops to help you continue to make that happen, it's pretty hard for you to turn your back on those same people and charge one of them. So That's a problem, but that is the rule of law. That's what the rule of law provides for. And I know it's tough, and maybe that's one of the reforms that needs to occur, is that instead of the local county attorney who would normally have jurisdiction over these matters, maybe there's some legislation that says that there is special prosecutors set up to handle these, so we can avoid that type of a conflict.
But we know that's going on, right? So there have been other circumstances, well, where, for instance, there was an alleged crime committed where somebody was killed by a police officer in, say, Brooklyn Park, Brooklyn Center, hypothetically, and that that actually was sent over to the Washington County Attorney's Office because they were concerned of, well, at least the appearance of bias and making sure there was an objective decision as to how something like that might be charged.
Yeah, but I think that's a little bit different. That was that coalition between these county attorneys,
right,
where if I'm the county attorney in County A, and I've got one here, I pass it off to somebody in County B, and in theory, that should take care of the problem. I don't know all the details. I spoke with somebody yesterday that's a little bit more familiar with the details than I am, but for whatever reason, Keith Ellison, the attorney general, stepped into that one as well. I don't know why, but that's not that coalition is not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about something that's formalized where there is a special prosecutor available to deal with these types of situations that can come in, doesn't have to worry about these inherent conflicts that a normal county attorney would have to be concerned about.
Do you think that sometimes can work? I mean, I've worked very closely with a couple of county attorneys, and I recall they know, and this is the secret, if you will, they know who some of the bad cops are too. They do. I don't want to depend upon that guy to take the stand because we know that guy's or that woman is or whatever, and so what we get is the essentially doing nothing about allowing that bad cop to continue on the street, but sort of internally knowing that they're not of the highest caliber.
Yeah, and I agree with you there, but then you've got the other dynamics about, but if we turn against one, then we face this problem of you turn against one of us, you've turned against all of us. And so then you got the cops sitting down, and then now, as a county attorney, yeah, we all know, this particular one or this handful of them are problem kids, we'll call them. But you come against one of us, you come against all of us. It's kind of that's what it's looked like historically.
Yes,
and so that's a problem. That's a real problem. And I think if you have an independent prosecutor that doesn't have to rely on those folks day in and day out, then you take that out of the equation.
Is that enough? Is it enough to basically say we're going to have independent prosecutors out here who will go after police officers, and that somehow that's going to be enough to expect that they're going to be of the standard that we would demand of law enforcement?
Absolutely not. No, it takes much, much more than that. And I just want to make one thing really clear. A lot of people listening to this might say, yeah, you got these two defense guys on here. Of course, they're saying all this bad stuff about the cops. I am not anti-police. I do not support getting rid of police departments. I do not support defunding the police. But what I do support wholeheartedly is good policing. Look, police officers do stuff every single day that none of us regular folks want to do. Here's an example. You got an active shooter. I'm going the opposite way. I'm running away from the shooter. Good police officer going toward the shooter.
Wait, isn't that what Donald Trump said when he said he would run into the school? Something like that?
Well, and sometimes that's really true. I mean, sometimes that is really true. That's the type of stuff that good police officers do.
Right.
The other thing that they do is day in and day out, they're dealing with situations that a lot of times we don't even know about. Why don't we know about them? Because we don't have to deal with them. Why don't we have to deal with them? Because they do. But here's where there's a big rub that has been ignored for far too long. We put these people in these situations. We expect them to do all of these things to handle problems that none of the rest of us want to handle. And frankly, a lot of them I'm not going to handle. I can't speak for anybody else. But I think the average citizen says, I'm not going to do that. And we don't provide them with good training. We don't provide them with adequate support in terms of how to process a lot of the things that they have to deal with. And we expect that they just show up every day and continue to do that. And it doesn't work. Let's look at it from this perspective. If you look at the type of training and support that a local police department or local police officers would get, and you compare that to what federal agents get, it's night and day difference. Local police, if they go through the academy, they get a little bit of skills training, how to shoot guns and deal with handcuffs and apprehend people and maybe a little bit on how to interrogate. But that's about the extent of it. They don't get any training on how to process trauma and how to process grief and all those other things that show up. And instead, what happens is they go out, for example, they go on a suicide call, or they go out on a call where a baby's been killed, or they go out on a bad domestic, and they deal with this stuff, and they just have to process it the best way they can, and usually that means they stuff it, right? And it never gets dealt with. Well, when you stuff it for so long, pretty soon it's going to show up. It's going to either show up in the cop doing something crazy on the street, or it's going to show up with the police officer drinking or doing drugs, or, you know, they take that stuff home with them too. So now we got problems in the home. All those things start to happen, and it doesn't have to be that way.
Yeah.
It doesn't have to be that.
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you what, Rick, thank you so much for taking the hour with me.
Absolutely. Thank you for inviting me. This has been a very good and a very important conversation.
Fantastic. Rick Petrie. Again, he currently serves as the Assistant Director of the Career and Professional Development with Mitchell Hamlin School of Law. But we've been talking about this issue of where law enforcement goes. Stay with us. There's a lot more coming up. Again, this is my first hour. A lot more happening. My name is Jack Rice, filling in for Matt McNeil just for today and maybe another day somewhere down the road. Stay with us. A lot more coming up on AM 950.